What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. Today on the program, I talk to Matt Brunick, an American lawyer, blogger, policy analyst, commentator, and founder of the left-wing think tank, People's Policy Project. He was a blogger for the American think tank Demos, covering politics and public policy, and has written on issues including income distribution, taxation, welfare, elections, and Scandinavian economic models. Also joining us is my co-host, Leslie Lee. Leslie Lee is a writer, critic, and broadcast journalist, and host of his own podcast, Struggle Session. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, and as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including an alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. And with that, please enjoy our conversation with Matt Brunick. Matt Brunick, hello.
Hey, how are you?
Good, you?
I'm doing well.
Great, thanks for coming on.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for having me.
I don't know if you guys have met IRL or online, Leslie Lee.
No, online we've chatted.
Tweeted.
Yes, but never in person. But very nice to meet you, man.
Nice to meet you, Leslie.
You guys are both from, I mean, different places, but Matt is from the state of Texas.
Oh.
And Leslie is from
Louisiana.
There you go. We border
one
another.
So spent a lot of time in Texas.
So.
Yes.
Yeah. So there you go. I just wanted to give you guys that to bond over.
All right.
And I'm sad
I didn't know you were from Texas, Matt. I gotta admit, you don't necessarily give off Southerner energy. I don't know if that's
BSE.
Deliberate, if you're ashamed of your redneck past, as Ben Folds says in the song, but I don't want to blow up your spot, you know, if you're trying to keep it undercover.
I have to drop all the inflections and stuff and try to speak like a Northerner to be taken seriously.
Is that your, like, not to sound like a total terrible, I don't know what the word is, but is this your, like, the accent you grew up with?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I grew up in the Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex, you know,
right.
So if you're in a city, I don't know, all cities are kind of similar in some respect. I think it's more once you get out into the rural areas that it really gets thick, so.
Yeah. Well, I got into a lot of trouble when I went after, what's her name?
Amy Coney Barrett.
Yeah. I was listening to her and I thought she sounded like, kind of like someone from Long Island. And I jokingly said, like, this is cultural appropriation and it's not okay. And then I didn't know that there's this whole cool, like, New Orleans accent. And in fact, I got to get Adolph Reed back on the show to break it down for me. But people were so, and then people are like, really? That's what you care about? I'm like, yes, it is so much more problematic than her pro-corporate, you know, reactionary it pales in comparison to that. You know, those pale in comparison. People are like, oh my God, I can't believe this person. Anyway, it was fun. But Matt, wanted to love having you on, and love that you are, you know, the People's Policy Project is a great organization. It's a great think tank. And it's unique because it's actually a crowdfunded, crowdsourced think tank, which is rare and really important. In fact, before you guys created that, I didn't realize how important that was. Like, because we're so used to a world where think tanks are funded by incredibly wealthy people or institutions or interests. And before we get into the near tandem stuff, and, you know, don't worry, guys, this is not a petty thing. This is about policy. But before we get into that, how did you even realize that there was, like, a need to create a think tank that wasn't,
I lost all my jobs.
Well, it does kind of relate to the Nira thing, actually.
Yeah. No, it's directly related to it. I lost my job at Demos and then my job at the National Labor Relations Board. And, you know, I thought I could make a go of it. And, you know, it turned out to be the case. I can't make, like, a ton of money on the think tank. In fact, I make more on my podcast than the think tank. But it's enough to write, five or six nice papers a year and get them nicely designed. And then just kind of keep in the news and try to, like, influence, news coverage and the direction of bills and stuff like that. You know, it's enough to kind of get that off the ground. So yeah, it's worked reasonably well. And you're right. I mean, the other think tanks, they get their money from primarily foundations, very high net worth individuals, or the Gulf states.
Right.
It's to pour a ton of money into the think tanks. And it's funny because it's one of the things I've had to, like, grapple with for a while. I mean, I think I've done a good job of getting taken seriously as a think tank. Like, I get quoted all the time in newspapers, and, like, members of Congress and stuff will reach out to me. But you do have people who occasionally are like, this is a fake think tank. This is not, and I'm kind of like, what's a fake? Why is it fake?
Right.
What makes it fake? And it's like, implicitly, it's like, well, it's fake because you're not getting money from the Gulf states or the Bill Gates Foundation.
Right.
It's like, well, yeah, I get money from real people. If anything, I'm the legitimate one, and they're all fake.
And your podcast is The Brunix.
That's right.
Which is a great podcast, yeah. Which you co-host with your fellow Southerner, fellow Texan partner.
That's right. Elizabeth Brunig of the New York End Times.
Yes. I wanted to have you on because I have a kind of, it's not a Neera Tanden obsession, and it's not because she came up with a term for me. Do you guys want to know the term she came up for me?
Yes. Or
with for me? It's, Dalton Socialist. So I went to this school, it's a private school called Dalton, and it deserves the ridicule that it will get for being a ritzy private school.
Is that where Matt Iglesias went?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
We were the same year, actually. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Did you know him?
And he had hair like to here. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's exciting.
We took Russian fiction together.
Wow.
Yeah. And
you had Russian fiction?
Russian literature. Yeah. Russian literature, I think. It's an elective.
At your high school?
Yeah. That's what I was saying. Ridicule it if you must. I understand. I do the same thing. Yeah. And then I taught there. But, it's funny. It's like, so she uses this word. Either she created it or someone else did, and she uses it. And it's obviously about me, not to sound whatever, because long story short, Iglesias is not someone she would call a socialist. And I don't know who else, any other lefties who went there, who she would want to be hostile towards, at least.
Right.
Dean Wareham of the band Luna, who's a Bernie fan, did go there, but don't think that's who she's talking about. So, the thing with the, you're like a perfect, and again, I don't want you to feel tanned and objectified. I've had on Matt to talk about healthcare. I've asked him about the Heroes Act, many things, minimum wage stuff. But there's something about the way that obviously her tweets about Republicans don't matter. And obviously, as my like fellow leftists, you know, point out, her tweets are not the issue. It's her policies, right? But to me, the reason that her Twitter presence does matter, Tandon's Twitter presence because, and I was like, I've been trying to think of it and I've been talking to editors and I can't, like, I have a bit of a Neera block in my head, but it's because I think she, in real life, she weaponizes identity politics and lived experience, right? To, she cites the fact that she grew up on Section 8 housing, she was on food stamps, and then what does she push? She pushes austerity. So she cites her background benefiting from these programs. And I don't mean that in a, I'm not at all like, it's good. People should be benefiting from these programs. My only thing is I'd, you know, like them to be less means tested. But there's no criticism for that. It's the criticism I have is that she benefited from these things and then wants to turn around and deprive others of things, right? She cites her being, you know, her parents were hardworking and her mother was from India and she's a woman of color. It's like, that's great. And you also cozy up to Netanyahu, want to steal the oil from Libya. Again, just a lot of things that are, that she uses identity and lived experience to cover for. And I think, and I'm going to ask you to elaborate on those things, but the Twitter thing that kills me is it's like she condemns and, you know, laments the online toxicity that exists, and you are one of the people she accused of doing that, demands that every single person, that Sanders, like, disavow, repudiate, condemn any and every random online person who either likes him or claims to like him. And then at the same time, she elevates people, hangs out with people in real life who say absolutely, like, misogynist, anti-Semitic, Islamophobic things. And people are like, who cares? It's her tweets. I'm like, yeah, of course it's her tweets. But there is something to her tweets that's significant. And then with you, I was like, oh, this is where it comes full circle, right? Because, and I'm going to ask you about this, but you and Tandon and Joan Walsh got into a policy fight, and that was resolved. Basically, they got you fired and cited your alleged online toxic behavior. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, that's really what it is. It's like her Twitter presence is the same thing as her real life presence, which is weaponizing identity politics, lived experience, and on Twitter, civility politics to actually push to try to neuter the left. And when you were fired from Demos, that was like kind of an example of what she tried to do. Anyway, that was me working stuff out with you and Leslie here. But can you share that what happened between you or among you and Walsh and Tandon?
Yeah. You know, so in the 2015 primary, I actually didn't know who Neera Tandon was before that point, but she got pretty active on Twitter at that point. I kind of wonder if she was, how active she was before then, because I feel like I would have noticed her, but she really got going then. And, you know, it was Bernie versus Hillary. Things were really heating up. And she just started tweeting at me for a while, and then I clicked on her name, and I was like, oh, it's an important person. I should follow her. And we would kind of go back and forth for a while, and one of the big trolls I used to do on her is every time she would tweet something about, you know, Hillary Clinton saying, you know, she's super progressive, and she takes no progressive backseat to Bernie Sanders, I would always say, this is why we can't nominate Hillary, because she's too progressive. She can't win the general election. And she would, this would really get her wound up. And I don't know, over time, I would just kind of agitate, you know, like that. Nothing ugly, just sort of screwing around, you know, like you do online. And then what happened was, when I got fired, is Joan Walsh wrote a piece at The Nation that was basically like, I could never support Bernie Sanders because all his supporters are, you know, misogynist, racist Bernie bros. Like, it's one of those pieces. And Hillary Clinton is the candidate of women and people of color. And I replied to Joan, you know that it's really about age. That if you know, young women are for Bernie and older women are for Hillary and young people of color are for Bernie. And you know, we see this in the polls. And, like, it turns out that there are more older voters than younger voters. So, like, overall, but, like, you know, I was sort of pushing back on that. And I kind of got tangled up with Joan about it. And then Neera comes into the thread. So Neera's not, you know what I'm saying? I'm not tweeting at Neera Tandon. And she comes into the thread and starts, you know, getting mad at me for, you know, criticizing Joan, I guess. And then we have the run-in where I'm like, well, you worked on welfare reform. Hillary Clinton worked on welfare reform. That was no good for me. And then, like you said, she's done this thing, and she's doing it now, even in her bid for trying to get through this OMB nomination, where she tries to use the fact that she was on benefits as a kid as a kind of identity shield to say, you can't criticize me for what I've done in politics. Very similar to, you know, how someone might say, well, how, you know, I'm speaking as a woman, you can't, you know, this or that, or speaking at, but in this case, it's speaking as someone who received AFDC, you know,
right.
Like, it's a really niche, weird identity to, like, you know, like, well, of course, the Section 8 community, and we all have very similar opinions and experiences. And, you know, it's like, it's a really weird thing to kind of pitch that way. But well, I said, yeah. Go ahead.
No, keep going.
I tweeted back, you know, well, Scumbag Nera uses welfare when she needs as it takes it away from others when they need it. And they decided to really fixate on, like, scumbag. Like, oh, and that, he's gone over the line. He used the word scumbag, which, of course, I don't know if people are real plugged in the internet know that was a reference to Scumbag Steve meme, which was a big thing at the time. So it wasn't even like I was calling her a scumbag. Even if I was, that's a pretty low-level taunt. Like, yeah, and then, I don't know, the one way or another, Demos fired me, put out a press release saying, you know, just a horrible abuser online, I guess.
And off this it went. Joan Walsh had called you a troll before or after you said this. It doesn't matter because I'm
before,
not justifying.
Yeah, before. Yeah, she was calling me a troll, and that's why Nera jumped in. I don't remember the full thread, but Nera basically was like, you know, I don't, in solidarity with Joan against Matt Brunig, the troll, who trolls me also, kind of thing, you know? So,
and then,
which, I mean, I did, but not in a, you know, like I said, like making fun of, like, whoa, if she's so progressive, then I guess she can, you know, like shit like that.
In a way that you would have with a straight white man.
She didn't accuse me. I don't think she's accused me of you know, going against her as a woman of color. Oh, okay. Thankfully, I don't remember her ever trying
That's
to pull
a lot
that
of self-restraint for her because she weaponizes that quite a bit. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, and so that was a fight, and then that turned into a whole thing, right? Where I mean, just going back a little bit when you said the niche thing. I mean, it wouldn't make sense if you were saying Section 8 housing, there's a logic and, like, moral, like, a morality and sense of justice to saying, I grew up under these conditions, and because of that, that's informed me and my perspective, and that's why I'm going to fight for people like that. People, you know, who, like my mom. But it is extremely sordid to use that and then say, you know, entitlements are on the table.
Yeah.
It's
weird, and but you do also see that in other groups, like they want to put, they'll take someone who has the relevant identity to really bring down the sword, because then they can kind of say, well, I grew up in this or that, or I've experienced racism or whatever, and then they do something that makes racism worse, or, you know, is bad for the economic prospects of people of color, something like that. But, you know, like, that's something that they do in all the groups, it seems like. It's a common strategy, but it's weird. It's a weird thing when someone is pointing out, hey, you cut this, for you to be like, how dare you, I used to be on it. It's like, well,
yeah, exactly. It's like, why you, it makes you a sellout, like, yes. That, like, she can call me, I mean, what she's saying to me is I'm kind of like a class traitor, which I will take, you know, any day. And I'm, again, not to make this about biography, but it's like, if you're gonna point to your biography, I mean, this is like the neoliberal version of someone like the Ben Carson story, right? Where he just overtly says, I made it and so can these people. Like, the Tandon argument doesn't go that far because that's like very right wing, like overtly right wing. But her thing, their thing is like the, everyone has a chance. And she even uses the word grit, like with her mom.
Yeah. No, I think the right wing line is to say this experience informs the reason why I want to get rid of it. In her case, I'm not even sure I would say that Tandon, she's an operator. She wants to be in mainstream Democratic politics. The reason she worked on welfare reform is because she thought it would help her in her career in mainstream Democratic politics. The same reason why in 2010 she came out for cutting Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Right. I wouldn't say, like, it's almost like
it's
she's not the kind of creature who you can be like, what's her real views? It's like, she likes to be in the Democratic Party. Like, that. Those are her views. She likes her career in politics. But so she just kind of used it as a shield as necessary when having a career in politics means going with the flow on something that actually is counter to what would have benefited her as a kid. But you make a good point. I mean, the Ben Carson point, this is the one of the early problems I kind of identify, because when you're coming up, you know, as a I don't know, teenager, and you're getting interested in left politics, you know, you can get sucked into like different modes of doing it. And one mode of doing it is very kind of like, well, what's my experience and what does that tell me about this or that? And it occurred to me as someone who could maybe say, hey, I came from the working class. Look at my single mom who worked at the JCPenney, you know, right, or whatever. That, well, a lot of people who come from that position, if they find themselves, if they find success, which they need to find in order to be in a position where they can opine, like you don't get in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times if you grew up poor and then stayed poor. Like, that doesn't happen. It's only if you've gone up the ladder. But then that experience, that's not a good experience for you to then talk about, like, because that is a rare experience. And if you look through the whole world through that lens, you're going to get very distorted views about what's possible and what's common, and, you know, and you're probably not likely to reflect enough on your own situation and say, damn, this was really lucky, you know, like, so I don't know. I don't find people with that background in particular who have also succeeded, those are oftentimes the worst people who have the worst politics because of that experience, you know?
Yeah. Especially when, I mean, overtly conservative right-wing thing, it's like kind of overtly sadistic and punishing, right? It's like, I made it, and these people, they think that they're going to get by, they want handouts. Like, I made it through hard work. And with the, like, neoliberal, like, meritocracy, technocracy class, it's like, if you give people a fair shot, like, there is, you know, it's all about, like, making it so that 1 out of 10, like, Black families can make it, just like 1 out of 10 white families can make it, as opposed to 1 out of 20 or whatever, you know. I'm grabbing these numbers out of thin air, but
yeah, a social mobility story. Yeah. We'll re-throw those dice every 10 years, and who gets to be very poor and who gets to be very rich. And it's like, well, I'd rather just squeeze the differences as opposed to, you know, move people around the hierarchy. But yeah, I think people just, they have a bad sense of their own story, and then their politics, you can kind of get into this little loop where you think you've done really well and you're very proud of yourself and what you've succeeded at. That kind of pushes you towards, hey, if I can do it, then anyone could do it, and then that kind of moves you to the right, and then as you get more to the right, you then rethink your own experience through the lens of your right-wing politics. Right. And then you start, your story gets retold in your own head and you start shaving off things. Like, I mean, I think about in my own situation, obviously I've been very successful, I guess, you know, as far as these things go. But there's so many moments where it's like, this could have easily gone one way or another.
Right.
Like, I mean, one is when I was in high school, I scored on the top, I don't know what it was, like 0.3% on the PSAT, and that gets you national merit designation, which is why I got a full ride scholarship at the University of Oklahoma. But like the difference between the like being in the top 0.3% and being in the top 0.4%, which would not get you that, is like one or two questions, and I for sure guessed on one or two questions, you know, like that I probably got right, just luck of the draw, you know. So,
right. I mean, yeah. There's a humility that goes with that, right? That's not like by the sheer grit. It's my determination, you know, and the American dream means that I get a chance at this. You know, it's like the Hamilton musical or Hillary Clinton's like tested slogans. You know, it's all about just making it more. Not leveling the leveling, I guess, the playing field. It's not an egalitarian mission. It's just a meritocracy one.
Yeah, it's about making making society fair in the sense that everyone winds up in the part of the hierarchy they're supposed to be on, as opposed to saying this hierarchy is a mess, let's level it as much as we can. And I mean, it's still important, even when it's leveled, to at least try to make sure the positions are open to everyone and that kind of, but like in our society as it exists right now, it's the gap between the top and the bottom is so, is these the bigger issue than, you know, who manages to get the Wall Street job or who manages to get the big law job or, you know, whatever the paths are like that. That's just, it's just swamped by the overall inequality.
Yeah. Leslie, do you have any, I have a bunch more questions, but just wanted to.
Yeah. It's just, and you know, it doesn't matter what your background is, because if you're a poor person who makes it to a level, a level where you can talk to Neera Tanden and you have a different opinion than those in power, you're just ignored or not listened to anyway. So like it doesn't matter. And if you're a rich person who's never had to suffer, but you espouse whatever the liberal status quo is, then of course your experience and your lived experience is, you know, extremely, extremely important and worth taking seriously.
Yeah, I've written before about this sort of double bind, which is a sort of related to what Leslie's saying, that if you kind of think about people as only being able to talk about issues if they have some kind of authentic connection to them based on their background and experience, when it comes to poor people, they do wind up in a situation where if you grow up poor or lower class or working class and you stay there, of course, you don't get any traction on anything. I don't know, maybe these days you could get a podcast going or something like that, but certainly in the like elite media, right? If you grow up there and you stay there, you don't, you're just not in a position to intervene in the discourse. If you grow up there and you advance, then one thing they'll do, if you do try to play that game, which I've always just said I'm not playing the game, is they'll say, well, okay, yeah, when you were a kid, but look at you now. Like, you know, like, they'll say, well, you're not poor now, so who do you speak for now? And it's like, well, yeah, you know, so who can speak for them then? They can't speak for themselves, because if they pitch the Wall Street Journal, that doesn't get published. I can't speak for them, because even though I have some connection through my childhood, I don't really have a connection now. I mean, my income's quite high. So who then? It's like, well, nobody, you know, like the schema doesn't work for economic position, I guess, in the same way that it might work for other groups, because of course you have highly educated and highly paid women and highly educated and highly paid black people and trans people and whatever. But if you're highly educated and highly paid, you can't be poor. You can't, you know. Like, so.
Right. Yeah, it's true. Yeah. I mean, to me, it's just like a question of, are you using your lived experience to fight for the people who've come from that community, or are you using it to fight against them? And I guess it's almost like there's a refreshing honesty and directness about the Ben Carson position, because it's so overt, right? Like, no, it's not, it's, there's nothing subtle. There's nothing like undercover. He's like, I survived this community because handouts are bad, which is why we have to dismantle the welfare state and not give people handouts. And if we give people handouts, that's what keeps them trapped in poverty. But like, the Tanden position is not that, but it's also like, you know, like, look at, okay, obviously it's just a question of like, 10 minutes. If I haven't mentioned Bernie Sanders, just wait 10 minutes more and I will. But like, the way that he grounds his politics and his lived experience, right? So like, his family being wiped down in the Holocaust. I mean, that's actually a really pertinent example, because we were talking about the Michael Che joke before. But like, yeah, you have some Jews grounding their, using the experience of the Holocaust to justify what I would describe as very, you know, as like basically as ethnic cleansing. And you don't have to you don't have to equate it with the Holocaust to see that that's what the founding of Israel was. And then you have people who use that to say, that's why I, you know, it's this, these experiences make me committed to not allowing for more oppression and, let's say, ethnic cleansing. And so it's always a question of just like, who gets to wear that label and you know, elevate that mantle. And That's what is scary about. I think identity politics are good. I think what's scary about the weaponization of identity politics.
Yeah, I mean, you can use background narratives to kind of go in any direction you want, really. So if you're trying to defer to what people's opinions are based on whether they can present some kind of background narrative, you could go really any which way. I mean, like you mentioned with the Holocaust, obviously you can have someone who's just really strongly in favor of, you know, social justice and oppressed peoples, and especially people oppressed based on their religion or ethnicity. And like, you could go that route, or you could go another route and say, well, look, I mean, everyone in who's pro, I don't put this delicately, but, the people who are some of the more, strongest apologists of what Israel gets up to, they often dip into the exact same historical narratives and backgrounds and say that's why it's so important that we have a strong muscular state that is a Jewish ethno state and all the rest of it. So you could go anywhere with it, really.
Right. It's just that one side always gets, like, whichever side is more funded or more powerful gets to claim that they really represent the real ones.
Right.
And what else? Do you have any other insights into what needs to be done? Like, anything that you hear from the Biden administration that you want to call out for being particularly, like, dishonest? Because I think something that happens a lot is that people who are on the left, like, we're not experts. Like, I don't know. We're susceptible, I think, sometimes to the argument that, like, this is a great idea, but it's just not doable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. You know, it's kind of funny to try to figure out what is Biden even up to? Like, it's so quiet. They're spending
except
a lot
bombing
of
Syria, apparently.
Oh, yeah. No, on the foreign policy and on immigration and that stuff is kicking off for sure. And it's been a total disappointment. I mean, I guess, depending on what you expected.
Yeah.
It turns out that these sort of concerns on the border were Trump specific, not policy specific among Democrats. Same thing with certain foreign policy things, but that's, I don't know. I kind of figured that for a long time. And the areas that I work on, which are economic policy and, you know, benefits and, minimum wage and labor and like all that kind of stuff. It's just, we're just kind of waiting and seeing on this COVID bill. I don't know if you guys saw today, you may have been on the show when it happened, but the parliamentarian of the Senate, said no.
Okay, what is that? I have to admit, I don't know, what is the parliamentarian of the Senate?
It's like a job. You could get it if they wanted to hire
Leslie
you.
Leslie and I apply? We should have a conversation.
Yeah. I don't know what kind of background they would require, but it's not elected or anything like that.
It's some nerd who read Robert Rules of Order.
Right.
Yeah.
And ostensibly is supposed to be deciding on certain parliamentary procedures and
whatever. Is this point of order in timely or shit like that, but it comes most of the time it's whatever, but it becomes important in this very narrow case where to pass the reconciliation bill, which is like a once a year kind of thing where you can get a bill done with 51 votes, which is weird, like why can't they all pass with 51 votes, but that's how it is. You can cram it through this reconciliation bill, but there's a requirement that it pass something called the Byrd Rule, and the relevant part of that is whatever you're putting in this bill, it needs to change government spending or government revenue, which the minimum wage actually does, because if you change the wages, it has actually quite a lot of cascading effects on revenue. I mean, for example, if someone makes higher wages, they pay higher tax. And they also receive less benefits, you know. So that part is not a problem. But there's a caveat to that, which is that the revenue and spending that you do through your policy change, it can't just be, quote, merely incidental to the non-budgetary aspects of the provision or something like that. And so that becomes a question, which is, are these budgetary impacts of the minimum wage, which are tens of billions of dollars, are they merely incidental to a non-budgetary thing, which is changing the minimum wage? And there's like, what is this? This is this science? What are we doing here? Like, yeah. You know, like you could, anyone could say yeah or no. I mean, right. You know, it's bullshit ultimately.
Yeah.
And they've
it's
let
like
a lot
the
of
law on people. Yeah.
Yeah. And they, and it's like, but there's like, there's not like a case law on it or something. Like at least with some of the vague aspects of the vague aspects of law, you have, you know, 100 cases, you know, that judges have decided, and you can kind of look at those and kind of figure out where the line is. Here it's just like one-off things that they occasionally throw out, but they've done some weird ones over the years. So the weirdest one, which people keep pointing out, is I think 3 years ago they did one where the Republicans wanted to open up drilling in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge to oil and gas drilling, and they let that go through because it does increase government revenue, because that's a federal land and you can lease it out and make money. But it's like, how's that not merely incidental to the budgetary part? And if it's not, how is the minimum wage merely incidental? Like, it's either they're both on one side of the line or the other.
Right.
But yeah, that's how it's turned out. So
yeah,
and kind of the key takeaway about this is it actually doesn't matter. The vice president can just overrule them. Kamala Harris could just overrule this person, but the Biden administration has said they won't do that because reasons.
Yeah, no, she could overrule it. And it's like, guess what? Kamala Harris was the attorney general of California. I think she's probably more qualified on who can interpret what laws mean than the parliamentarian. You know what I mean? Like, it's not, the parliamentarian doesn't have any special insight into what the words merely incidental mean that Kamala doesn't also have. And she probably has more because she's an actual experienced lawyer. So there's no well, Kamala's not an expert on this kind of thing. It's just a decision that they're making. They also could fire the parliamentarian, which the Republicans did in 2001 when they weren't getting the answers that they wanted. So
who is this person? I want to know who they are.
What's their name? I don't know who the current one is.
What sign are they? Are they born in...
I don't know.
Whatever those things
it's,
are.
It's Elizabeth McDonough. Hmm. Who she's been there since 2012.
Sounds like there may be time to Leslie, you want to go for it or you want me to?
No, go ahead.
All right, I'll go ahead and do it, yeah. But I know the reason I brought up the law is because, you know, Samuel Moyne has been on the show a few times, and I had him on when RBG died, and he was saying, you know, that judges pretend that they're not doing politics through the law. Like, they pretend that they're just, you know, what is it, like, calling strikes and balls or whatever.
Right, yeah.
My words, not his. But, and it's the same thing with politics, right? I mean, especially Democrats love pretending that their hands are tied, that they can't do anything about it, that they'd love to. But if they wanted to, they could.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. They like to have these little pressure valves where they can kind of go, oh, well, the parliamentarian said this, or we can't do that because of the filibuster, or because the filibuster is another one. And I pointed this out back in 2008 or 2009 when I was like a nobody, but I was still fighting the war, the posting wars, you know, is they tried to defend the fact that the Democrats kind of pursued a pretty weak agenda under Obama, even though they had like 59 votes in the Senate. Like, they had a pretty solid situation there, and it was very weak. And people say, well, there's a filibuster. And of course, you say, well, you can get rid of that literally at any time. It's not even a thing where, like, well, you could have gotten rid of it at the beginning of the session, but now we're stuck with it. You can get rid of it at any time, and you can also get rid of it just for that bill if you want to. And the weird thing was is that although they didn't do that to make the Affordable Care Act better, they didn't do that to make the stimulus better, about a year or two later, when the Republicans were filibustering all the judicial nominees, they got rid of the filibuster so they could get judicial nominees in. So it was like, see, you could have done this the whole time. And even today, it still kind of survives. And there's this like weird, bizarro world where people now realize, wait, we can actually get judges in without the filibuster, but then still go, well, the filibuster, what can we do about that? And it's like, well, we the thing that lets you do the, you just do that. But you know, I don't know, people like external constraints that they can point to instead of having to just say, you know, I don't think this is a good idea or right. whatever. So
that's, I mean, I think that's what the whole Bernie Hillary thing revealed, right? It was people who pretended that they would have gotten on board with this. Of course, if these were viable positions, we would do it. I'd be backing it. But then when that person came out and was, they didn't. And so, you know, like the libs and centrists can hide behind the, oh, I would love that. It just won't work.
For so long.
Yeah.
Yeah, they want to, because they are kind of, you know, they don't want to, and this was, goes all the way back to the kind of messing with NERA in 2015. They don't, for whatever reason, unlike Joe, who kind of was relished in being like a moderate, who just I'm just not for that stuff. There are a lot of people who work in the moderate part of the Democratic Party who, for whatever reason, are just very insecure about that and are very much like, I don't know. I'm a lefty. I'm to the left of Bernie.
Yeah.
So you can kind of, that was part of the freak out. Like you pointed out, I think that was part of the freak out with Bernie was, well, here you go. Here's the one you say, you're here. So here's a guy that you could do it. So
let's go. Right. Do you, how much of the online like discourse do you think, I mean, you lost your job, but how much of the online discourse and the narrative about the toxic Bernie bros? I mean, it was definitely picked up and perpetuated by people, Joan Walsh, The Nation, Joanne Reed, MSNBC. How much do you think that shaped versus just reflected kind of politics?
I don't know that it really shaped much of anything. I think it was just a nice kind of convenient way to give a non-policy reason for why they don't like Bernie, right? So kind of goes back to the other thing, right? They don't want to have to say, no, I just don't like national health insurance, or I just don't like, you know, 15 minimum wage, or I don't like whatever it might be, free college, or, you know, go on down the list. They want to be able to say, yeah, I'm kind of there, but it's not practical. He can't win, or maybe he could, but you know what? I don't like other aspects of him. I don't like his, you know, white male toxic bro followers or whatever. That seemed to be opportunistic. And then there also seemed to be just, I don't know, like, you know how it goes. When elections get going, things heat up and there are people, mostly just kind of anonymous people that you just don't really have any attachment to, who kind of get fired up. And depending on which side you are on in the election, that also determines what kind of assholes you get in your mentions.
Of course, right?
So, like, I got tons. I mean, if you get it too, I've seen you point this out, like, tons of vicious abuse from Hillary people.
Yeah.
And then Tandon's got her own weird ass crew on there who's like,
hi,
obsessed
Regina.
With her. Yeah, Reg Wag, and
they
went wild today. I don't know if you saw that with Washington
with that
Post reporter.
Who making Asian racist jokes about.
It got pretty bad.
They called her Uncle Tom. They called her a coon, actually.
Yeah,
which makes no sense.
Leslie, they're actually post racial.
You don't get to use coon against a Korean woman.
Yeah.
Because I know you're not black if you're using that word for a Korean woman, first of all. I know you're not actually black. You might be a POC, as they used in the word. They said that this woman had betrayed another POC, which is another reason I know people, they aren't black, because, like, black people don't get into the whole, like, we're all POC now. No, we're still black. We're still black. That's a distinct identity. You don't get N-word pass just because you're a POC. That means nothing, you know.
Right.
So I
that's
absolutely
really
wild stuff from from goddamn Neera Tanden people.
You should call them all out. Just call them out.
Hey, I do have to say, though, her weirdos are disproportionately black. A few I've confirmed. She seems to have like two
eclectic
two weirdo black and
Mr.
black
Weeks.
Guys. Yes,
an eclectic.
Yeah, she got two of them. So I mean, that is just maybe three. Maybe three when you talk about Lobster And,
yeah, collected.
Oh,
lobster.
And then you got Smooth Flexen.
Smooth Cobra. He's white. He's married to a black man. Jeremy's a gay white Marcus Johnson.
Marcus Johnson.
Smooth Cobra. Sorry, I was thinking of Smart Flexen.
Yeah, so actually, if you could have like a whole black men for Nera like group if you really wanted to. So
Mr. Weeks.
I gotta give her points on that.
Mr. Weeks is the best.
I give you your points.
Mr. Weeks was buying mobile billboards.
Yeah, he drove around in a truck that said, fuck Bernie Sanders. But you know what? This is why I'm so grateful to Horse Whisperer, who Jack Allison, friend of show, and co-host of Leslie Lee, helped expose, because he is just a straight white man. Like, you can't do a lot with that. And yes, he is a Nera, you know, a Nera troll, a Tandon troll. He defined Breonna Joy Gray as white adjacent bro fodder. Said all these economic justice issues are like the priorities of straight white heterosexual people. It's like, well, I guess you would know, Mister. Yes. And he's like an executive or something. He like does marketing for like
military contractor like marketing. Like he like and like insurance company. Like all the worst people. Yeah. In the world, and Jack was able to dig down. Matt, I did want to give you props because I saw that the Democrats floated actually using one of your fake think tank ideas out there with, what was it, a child?
Child allowance.
Sorry, I wanted to ask you about that. Yeah, and then
yeah,
this is coming full circle. Actually, Brian Fredericks asked, "Could Matt comment on Romney and Biden's child benefit policies?" That's what you're
talking
about,
right,
Brian? Leslie?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I mean, I've been writing about this for like 4 or 5 years and trying to tee this up. But I mean, the long story short is we do actually have child benefits in the U.S., though people don't really realize it or think about it because of how weirdly it's designed and how hard it is to understand. But they are called the child tax credit and the earned income tax credit. But the way that they're designed is if you're poor, or even if you maybe not totally poor, but you don't make enough income, you don't get the full benefit. So it's, you really kind of got to be in like the top 70% of the income distribution to get these benefits. And this was an intentional thing they did in the 90s when they were cutting welfare, because the idea was we need to keep cash away from these poor single mothers, and so let's move it up the ladder and using these tax credits to do that. And so I've been saying for 5-6 years, that's fucked up. Like, we should just extend these down to everyone to make sure poor people get them as well. And I had a whole scheme for like how we should do it. And it kind of took off, and a lot of people, you know, got on board. There were papers at some of the other think tanks supporting an idea like that. And eventually Joe Biden, they convinced him in one of his, I don't know, moments to sign a piece of paper saying he's for it, I guess. They're trying to get that into the COVID relief bill. And the way that he's got it set up is you would get $300 a month per kid if they're below the age of 6. Above that, you would get $250 a month. But it's an advanced monthly refund of your child tax credit. It's actually kind of a clusterfuck in the way that he's designed it. And that brings me to Brian's question, which is the Romney one. Romney then came out with a counter, and I actually was able to interact with some of Romney's staff on that proposal. And Romney's proposal is actually slightly more generous than Biden's proposal, believe it or not. It's about you can get $350 a month instead of $300 a month. So that's cool. And you also get $1,400 right before you give birth, whereas you don't get that for Romney or for Biden's plan. But the thing that is interesting about Romney's plan is that he adopts my approach to administering the benefit. So instead of having the IRS pay out an advanced monthly version of an annual child tax credit, you just have the Social Security Administration send the check out to everyone. Super, super easy, very, very salient. The Social Security Administration already sends out benefits to 3.8 million kids every month. People don't know that. They think about it's only old people. It's not only old people. Kids get some Social Security if their parents die or they're disabled or something like that. And so that's where we're at right now, is basically me trying to convince everyone, if, whatever you think about Romney's proposal, at least use the way that he's designed it. Like, that is the way that other countries do it. That's the best way to do it. And I don't know. That's not, I've actually had a lot of success on that in the discourse. Like, Vox, Dylan Matthews at Vox wrote a whole piece that was basically like, the Romney plan is better design. And then the New York Times editorial board did the same thing. And, you know, so I've just started beating the bush on that. That's basically what I've been spending the last month on. But they're probably going to go with the dumbass design, you know, at the end of the day, so.
You can follow Matt Bruenig on Twitter at Matt Bruenig. That's B-R-U-E-N-I-G. And read more of his work with the People's Policy Project at peoplespolicyproject.org. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content. Thanks again for listening to The Katie Halper Show. Our show is produced by me, Katie Halper, and Nick Palm. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman, and our intern is Maria Trujillo. Our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you on the next episode.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.